Thanks, everybody. I think I'll start going while one or two others like this next gentleman comes, and we'll get moving. I'll leave the door open because there might be one or two more, if you don't mind. So thanks very much for coming. I'm going to move very quickly to introduce Sanjoy, who probably you recognise very well. He's been the quiet man who sits behind me during the previous 9 seminars this year, which he has organised with me on behalf of the Wellcome Trust Centre for the History of Medicine at University College London. So he's been sitting quietly through all these seminars, which many of you have been to, and I thank you again for coming to this one. And now it's his turn. And he's telling me this morning he's a little nervous, and I'm saying, look, how can you be nervous when you've already rehearsed this 9 times already? Sanjoy is a reader at the Wellcome Trust Centre for the History of Medicine in London. He's obviously an expert historian in his own right. He has a number of accomplishments in a number of areas to his credit. Smallpox is one of them, and on that alone, smallpox control and eradication, he's already the author of 2 very well received books and quite a number of articles on that subject. He's also the author of a book on health and information policies in colonial Eastern India, during World War II. He's been a really supportive influence on this whole project with the seminars, and we owe him a big debt for that. But now, Sanjoy, it's your turn. He's going to speak, I think, for about 45 minutes. We'll, as usual, open up for discussion, which has often proven to be a very, very stimulating part of the whole business. So be very free in coming up with questions and comments later on. And we'll let Sanjoy have the floor.
Perfect.
Welcome, Sanjoy. It's all yours.
Well, thank you. Thank you for making time to attend this presentation. My presentation results from work that I've already published and research that I'm carrying out within the WHO and elsewhere, and this is an ideal time to thank the archive staff who have been a wonderful source of support throughout my work over the last 10 years, and also I'd like to thank the library for allowing us to host this talk in this wonderful venue. Some of the work that I'm beginning to do relates to history and policy, and therefore I'd really love your feedback, especially on the second half of the talk, in which I'll try to raise some points about how the smallpox story, as I see it, might actually open up some avenues of, you know, rethinking how work is being carried out in South Asia at the moment. Now, I know that around the table there are some smallpox warriors. I'm told that this is Peter Carrasco, who I have corresponded with, but I'm delighted to make your acquaintance, and Alan Schnorr, whose brain I'm constantly mining about Bangladesh and India. And therefore, this is a rather beautiful picture, I thought, of the smallpox virus, a very dangerous virus. As most of you most probably know, variola is a causative virus. Variola major predominated in India. And why I've been deliberately vague about how many people it could kill, the percentage of people it could kill, is because I continue to believe that there is confusion in the field, or there are different interpretations that continue to exist when you talk to people in India, public health workers in India, about the impact of smallpox, which I think is very important. I mean, people don't stick to one definition about how many people smallpox had killed in the past. There are many interpretations. And this is, of course, a picture, again, that you'll be aware of. I think one of the most published pictures in history, distributed by the WHO, by teams traveling from village to village, town to town, trying to household to household, trying to find out if people had actually seen the case of smallpox. Now, it was a terrible disease. If you survived it, you could still be maimed for life. You could be blinded, you could be made sterile. I'll discuss the various sort of interpretations that existed about the causes for smallpox, but it was something that was feared, whether feared as a deity or a demon or just as a biomedical concept, a disease that could kill. And therefore, when smallpox outbreaks happened, people worried and governments sometimes panicked, and there were emergency responses. Now, I'd like just to point out here, sometimes when I speak at universities and I talk about WHO smallpox eradication campaigns, there's an assumption that I'm suggesting that there was no history of smallpox vaccination before the WHO campaign. And I've just put this slide in to point out, this is a picture from the 1930s, rural India, that there was, of course, vaccination, organized vaccination in colonial South Asia, in other parts, in Africa, and there were various ways in the 19th and 20th century in which people tried to control smallpox. One was, of course, inoculation, which was an attempt to use a weakened version of the variola virus to immunize people. Different types of isolation strategies were used, and of course, vaccination was used. And sometimes there's a tendency in history to look back at a particular example and say that, oh, you know, this is very similar to what we did in the 60s and 70s, and sometimes a rather suspect sort of teleological history is often created. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look back in history, you might even have odd examples which might look suspiciously similar to containment and surveillance, but it was not the containment and surveillance that was used in the 70s. And what happened in the 70s was very much a product that I will argue of its time, of the context in which the work was being carried out. And I think that is where history can help to show up. To point out the particular conditions existing in different localities where challenges were met and overcome. Another colleague of yours, John Wickett, who gave me this picture, I understand Peter Carrasco was involved in the last case. This was in Somalia. And what I'd like to point out here is that actually discussions in the WHO Health Assembly started in the late 1950s. And it took some time before a resolution was actually ratified that an organized effort should be launched to try and eradicate smallpox worldwide. And the question at one level was purely of finance. There were people who were supportive, but there was just not enough money to launch a global program in the early 50s, and the challenge continued in the late 1950s. Now, when you look at South Asia, you realize that after the passage of the Zhdanov resolution, it resulted in country-level negotiations about how best to organize an Indian chapter or a Pakistani chapter of a global smallpox eradication program. And South Asian national governments played a central role in these negotiations, mainly because in the earliest phases, it was expected that the South Asian national governments contribute financially to the development and the running of the program in a big way. And of course, these governments were important because they administered a region that was the largest reservoir of smallpox in the world. And a lot of smallpox importations outside Asia, especially exportations to Europe, were linked back to the South Asian subcontinent, particularly at a time when air travel was becoming more common, more prevalent, cheaper. easier to access. And, of course, you had Commonwealth immigration to countries like Britain, and some of these immigrants were found to have falsified vaccination certificates, would contract smallpox just before they left, and by the time the symptoms were visible, they were already in Britain, becoming a focus of infection. Now, what strikes me about the discussions that took place between the WHO and the governments of India and Pakistan in early 1960 was the question of money. A lot of administrators within the WHO and the governments were very supportive of the idea, but it's striking how difficult it was to convert that political will into financial support. And that is something I think historians have to remember and think any public health campaign, global or regional in focus, needs to have that financial backing. And I think the story of the 1960s is the struggle to raise sufficient monies to have an ambitious program going. The other striking thing is that there was a realization that there were shortages and variations in the available vaccine. I mean, some of the things that get ignored by professional historians because they think it is boring but is incredibly important is this negotiation, the complexities of the negotiation to ensure that the organization had enough vaccine to help develop a core program that would then blossom into a bigger, more ambitious global program. The first step, it seems to me everyone understood, was to get a successful core program going. Once you delivered on a core program, the expectation was, you know, success breeds success. Others come in, pay more money, and then you expand support. But that scaling up of operations actually only happens across South Asia around 1967-68. And it happens for what some people might consider were the wrong reasons. It happens because the Indian federal government almost decides to come out of the global smallpox eradication program. And this creates panic almost within the WHO because the realization that if India decided not to cooperate in global smallpox eradication, there would be no global campaign because of the cases, number of cases India had. So it took a sustained episode of Indian government disinterest to get the reforms going. And the reforms took the form of another very important figure in smallpox eradication, D.A. Henderson, making several trips to India, trying to negotiate with the health minister, the prime minister. And when you look at the minutes of the negotiations from the Indian side, it's fascinating. The Indian government agencies at that time were able to negotiate a financial arrangement that was beneficial to them, where the WHO committed itself to giving more financial aid. From the Indian side, they agreed to reorganize the smallpox eradication management structures. But if you really delve deeply into the papers, then you realize that the Indian government was also able to ensure that the WHO HQ agreed to insist on the reorganization of the Southeast Asia Regional Office and the way it was run. Because if you look at some of the confidential government correspondence, it is not just the Indian government that was weakening some of the plans. Or slowing down the implementation of some of the plans. It was regional office hostility as well to smallpox eradication that was causing problems. So this is where I think systemic analysis historically can help. And everyone had very good reasons for why they had doubts about smallpox eradication. And those doubts were very informative about the very particular challenges these officials had encountered in South Asia, which is why they felt that smallpox eradication might not work. But I think it took D.A. Henderson's open-mindedness to listen to views that were not necessarily his own, and then try to engage, communicate, talk, and then restructure the program with the help of many, many colleagues. Now, what you have, therefore, in the late 1960s is what I call an intensified program, because the rules of the game change. The Indian government, after being assured that there would be more vaccine being given as aid, more money given to them for smallpox eradication, they start coming on board. And the moment the federal government starts coming on board, at a time when India had a very powerful centralizing Prime Minister, Indira Gandhi, the state governments, at least on paper, start coming on board. And the Indian government, after initially refusing to give financial assistance, starts actually increasing its financial inputs. More importantly, perhaps, Indian government cleared personnel, many more international personnel, to work in India. Those of you who worked in India know that the Indian External Affairs Ministry can be a very is a ministry with officials who are very difficult to deal with. But there are indications that at this point of time, the procedure of clearing foreign officials to work in India became more efficient. And generally speaking, arrangements were made. Active arrangements were made to ensure that these WHO field officials could work more effectively with officials, Indian officials, at the district, subdivisional, and village level administrators. Now, of course, there were special zones. I mean, this period was not without its problems. I mean, you had the civil war, the Bangladeshi war of independence, whatever your perspective is, but this created problems during this period. There were regional rebellions and an Indian army backlash in northeastern India near the Chinese border. There was a coup in Bangladesh followed by political uncertainty. And there, of course, were other politically sensitive special zones where the government of India tried to enforce specific working conditions on WHO workers. And as Alan will know, the rules were broken, but in the sense that significant elements of risk were involved. You know, people would go quietly to places they weren't supposed to go to check if smallpox cases were indeed where they were being reported, even though sometimes national governments didn't really want the movement of officials. In Bangladesh, with Stan Foster and you, I think, found cases where the Bangladeshi government, I think, was claiming they had been rid of smallpox. I mean, these were very important sort of landmarks in smallpox eradication. But again, don't get mentioned in history is because national governments don't like to be presented as not being completely in control all the time. Now, what were the local administrative complexities? At one level, it is also striking for the historian to notice that there were bilateral agreements between national governments and funding agencies. So a very important case was the link between India and Soviet Union, which, apart from donating huge numbers of vaccine to WHO for redistribution, to countries involved in the eradication program, also give huge numbers of vaccine to India on a bilateral basis. And why are all these, why is a point like that important? And I think it's important because it did affect all aspects of the organization of the National Smallpox Eradication Campaign. that when you have bilateral arrangements and you have political agreements that underlie those bilateral agreements, there are some boundaries you do not cross, or there are some boundaries that are set as a result. So, you know, in the Indian case, it sometimes meant that there was an understanding that more Soviet workers would come in and work in India. Now, what about India? India was relatively stable politically. The Indian government insisted, as I pointed out, on clearing vetting foreign workers for service in India. The Indian authorities also pushed for the formation of mixed teams. This is something I found very interesting in the government archives, that they believed that teams with mixed workers of mixed nationality would be more effective, as they would keep an eye on each other as they worked in different localities. And this was particularly the case in the troubled northeastern region of India. There were, of course, parliamentary misgivings about, there was a classic case of members of the Communist Party of India standing up in Parliament and saying, why are we allowing American epidemiologists in the field? You know, they might be, you know, taking photographs of our defense installations. And but it was a point of view that I think was successfully dealt with in the 1970s. Pakistan and Bangladesh present a different picture. The Eastern Wing was in political crisis from the late 1960s, a very powerful linguistic movement, linguistic nationalist movement, was active in Bangladesh, what is now Bangladesh. Porous borders, and this is a picture that I've put here for a reason. The gentleman there is a Goanese doctor who was posted to Assam state in India near the Bangladeshi border. And the people there are Bangladeshi agricultural migrant workers who would come in on a seasonal regular basis. And what Dr. Bhonsle did was that he had an arrangement, he and his team had an arrangement where he knew who the workers were who were walking across unpoliced boundaries. He didn't report them to the local police, but he had a deal that you have to be vaccinated if I can't see a vaccination scar. And the arrangement worked wonderfully in that, you know, they got vaccinated, Bhonsle was happy, the police didn't have to know, maybe the police knew, didn't care. But this is, again, an important part of eradication programs. This is an important part of global health programs. Local law breaking, I think it's wonderful. But Bhonsle was taking a risk. He knew he was taking a risk. There is also another part to the story that I'll raise in more detail later on. Bhonsle was a Goanese. The two languages he spoke were Konkani and Marathi, Western Indian languages. He felt a foreigner in Assam, and when pushed, he acknowledged that he was completely reliant on interpreters. When he spoke to people or tried to find out that there were smallpox cases. So, you know, it raises questions about, you know, when one works in India, a country like India with such diversity, is it just simply all right to work with an Indian, or is it important in global health programs to find out, you know, where this Indian comes from and whether that Indian actually knows anything about the district where the work is being carried out? Because just being Indian in a country like India of subcontinental proportions does not mean that every Indian knows everything about a huge number of local complexities that exist. And I think one of the things that happens in the 1970s made more possible with a huge amount of money given by the Swedish International Development Agency, which created a special fund in the WHO, was the on-the-spur employment of workers drawn from the communities where work was being carried out. Now, at one level, they could act as interpreters. At another level, they could act as information, as people who could provide information about local conditions, local complexities. And as some people have pointed out to me, that this information would often in the past have been ignored by his or her superiors within the Indian health establishment. But when those ideas were articulated by foreign epidemiologists in a country like India, they were given credence and actually made the basis of policy. So the WHO worker, the WHO representative, had another role, the role to listen, but to also act as a conduit of local information, which sometimes was being ignored by superiors in India. So, of course, the Cold War cast a long shadow on smallpox eradication, and I'd like to highlight a few points. Vaccine imports were, for instance, affected by Cold War politics. And it's important to remember here that not all aid in countries like India or anywhere else in the world was distributed through the WHO. And this is where I think, at least during the smallpox eradication program, the Scandinavians played an extremely important role, because the Scandinavian agencies were actually willing to transfer vaccine technology to India, whereas other countries were offering actual vaccines as aid. And at a time when in the Indian political establishment, the mantra of self-sufficiency was very important, there was this sort of assistance was widely appreciated and welcomed. I mean, it created some complications because two or three vaccine production units in India started producing smallpox, freeze-dried smallpox vaccine, and there were regional there was a regional competition about who produce the best vaccine. But the point remains is that all this was happening in the background while immunization search and containment work was being carried out in the field. Now, vaccine usage was affected by global political trends and negotiations as well. Nationalism from all quarters was another important determinant. Suddenly, vaccines began to be given national labels. So, you know, there was the Russian vaccine, there's the Canadian vaccine, there's the American vaccine, there's the Indian vaccine. People had views about which one was better. There was no one view on this, but there were a variety of views which needed to be negotiated. I'm told by Larry Brilliant that some vaccinators made minor fortunes by providing Canadian vaccine rather than Soviet vaccine, because the Soviet vaccine was feared for the side effects. And so they would say, okay, you want the Canadian vaccine, you know, give me some money. And this is what Larry Brilliant said in a public lecture at the Wellcome Trust Center. That is his own experience, but not something I've come across in documentary evidence. Now, what were some of the practical considerations? Now, for instance, UNICEF was incredibly generous to the Indian smallpox eradication program in the late 1960s and early 70s, providing refrigerators for the districts and subdivisional capitals. The problem in India at that time was electrification was a rarity. So most people who went on reporting missions to districts would say that most of these refrigerators wouldn't be working and would be used to store books and other things. So again, a classic example of where aid was being given without sufficient research having been done about local conditions, which was a problem in the earlier phase of the program. Politics. Local politics was not just about talking to the politicians in power. It was also about talking to the politicians who were in opposition. Broad-based political support was very important, especially in trouble spots. Personnel, there was a difficulty in getting highly qualified Indian workers to settle in villages on a permanent basis. So although people were expected to spend long periods of time in the field, a system of management had to be devised where people would go and spend a long time in the field and then be replaced by other workers, and then some people would stay in the city and then later go back into the rural area. Shuffling of workers proved to be incredibly important. local officials had autonomy. Whatever national governments might say, local officials actually had tremendous autonomy. And that was partially due to the alliances with local politicians. And there were social pressures on local officials. Local officials had to stay in the communities where the work was being carried out. The international worker could come in and go out. But local responses was often shaped by the realization that even after the program was over, they would have to spend their lives in the local community. So often they would not be as pushy as some managerial staff wanted them to be. So is this an example, as some historians have claimed, of the West dominating exchanges with the East? In my view, not really. This is not sort of, what Navarro has, in his earlier writings, has referred to as the dominance of Western political economy over the developing country. That's not what I see in the smallpox eradication program. I think when you, and I've highlighted the last point, is that when you look at the complexities of the birth, and I put that in inverted commas, extension, an actual form of surveillance containment strategies, the importance of locality becomes very important. Now, there's one school of thought that believes that containment surveillance was tried out first in Western Africa, in the Western African program, by a set of extremely committed CDC officials, the Centers for Disease Control officials from Atlanta. The policy was seen to have worked and then transferred to other parts of the globe and became an important part of the global smallpox eradication program. I'm sure there is a lot of truth in that assertion, but it's not the only view. If you look at the archives and if you talk to other people, similar work was also being carried out in other locations. Now, what I'm not trying to do here, and I need to underline this, I'm not trying to write a rabidly nationalist Indian history of the program, but there was at the same time the West African program going on, WHO finance research in Madras on surveillance containment by a team led by A.R. Rao, funded by Henderson's unit in Geneva. And that threw up the same results. Now, my sense is that the adoption of containment and surveillance in India was not just a result of lessons learned from CDC experience in Western Africa, but also for some people, it was an uptake of an idea tried and tested in Indian conditions and therefore worth implementing in India. Now, if you look at, I think what we need to do as historians, and I think also as policymakers, is look at variations in attitudes. At any point of time, if you're looking at 1968 to 1970, there were a huge number of opinions about how policies were developed, how policies should be run. In any one locality, it was a combination of two or three combinations would come together and create complexities of policy implementation. So there was no, it was always a complex mosaic of attitudes and actions. And depending on the locality where the work was being carried out, that combination would often change. So I think it's useful both for academics and for policymakers to try and understand the variations in views, both amongst public health workers and those people who are being targeted, about what vaccination was all about and how to challenge any doubts that sometimes weakened programs. Now, for instance, when surveillance containment was launched, my sense is, and I'm very happy to be corrected on this, that different workers had different definitions of how to deploy it. Some of the about 20 or 30 Indian workers I've interviewed all had very different ideas about whether the circle of immunization should be 3 miles, 10 miles, 12 miles, 15 miles. It didn't matter. So So someone, when I asked someone, so why did you do 15 miles? Had enough vaccine? Didn't want to take chances. Some people would say no, but you know, the CDC manager I worked with taught me that it has to be a smaller sort of thing, and you know, I was copying that. Someone else would say, oh, but A.R. Rao's research showed that, you know, just to be safe, you have to do about 5 to 10 miles. So the epistemology, I hate this word, but I have to use it, you know, the birth of ideas is a complex one, and so is the uptake of ideas. And they're locally justified. So I think international workers and academics need to engage with that. Similarly, I'd like to point out that, you know, there was a multifaceted nature of resistance. I mean, I don't think anyone can doubt that there were instances of resistance in South Asia to smallpox vaccination. At the same time, I don't want to fetishize resistance and say it was everywhere. In my research, it wasn't everywhere. Again, think of what I was saying, the mosaic of attitudinal variations. So some people could resist, some would not. Some would get vaccinated and go to the Shitala temple, the temple of the smallpox deity. Some vaccinators I've interviewed would get their vaccination kits blessed by the smallpox goddess. So we are talking about very intricate negotiations, understandings of a disease and how best to control it. Religion is important in South Asia, but not as important as the media sometimes makes it out to be. Sometimes references to religion are the shortcut method to explaining resistance. I mean, a classic case was this wonderful DVD series that the Gates Foundation has funded on, you know, emerging diseases. And one of the DVDs actually has a small section of smallpox leading to a section on polio. Now, I'm lucky, I'm a Bengali, but brought up in Delhi, so I speak several Indian languages, and I have a lot of Muslim friends, so I speak Urdu and Hindustani. But when I look at the polio section of that DVD, I get worried. You know, behind Brad Pitt's wonderful, Stuart Broder's talk, thinking of the English cricketer, fast bowler, but Brad Pitt. wonderful delivery style. You know, you have to start thinking about what is being translated in the DVD and what is being lost in translation. When you look at that DVD, two vaccination workers, polio vaccination workers, are talking to the father. And certainly the father is often saying, inshallah, will of God, it's all up to God. But the women in the household are screaming from the background, giving their reasons for why they don't want their children vaccinated. That usually does not get translated in the DVD. Why not? We know from experience that women in households, South Asian households, grandmothers and mothers play an incredibly important role in immunization policy. Why are those voices not being translated? So I think one of the things the WHO has to do, because it has the power to do it, because it is a recognizable name. It was recognizable when I raised the money for this seminar series. It meant a lot to a lot of people, is that it needs to go and translate all the voices that you have about opposition to vaccination, whatever vaccination, not just polio, to health programs where they exist. This is a thing, you know, this is what should happen in an ideal vaccination, and this is something that happens when things go wrong. And I've only put that up just to point out that this was a major basis for opposition. Nothing to do with religion. At some points, it was a fear of post-vaccinal complications. Sometimes it was rumors describing a terrible post-vaccinal complication where the rumor would go on to say the hands were falling off, they'd heard. And not correct, but something workers had to engage with. And remember, many of the people vaccinated, were individuals being vaccinated, were babies, and so parents were worried. Diagnostic and structural problems. A bad case of chickenpox, case of variola major. Often you needed to send laboratory specimens for checking. Yes, he had an informal agreement, Dr. Bhonsle had an informal agreement with workers, but he was clever enough to realize that that arrangement might not work. So he had other arrangements in place as well, where people would be given rewards in open market days for reporting smallpox. But he faced problems setting up these reward systems, and these are structural problems. So the historian's epilogue. For me, as a historian, as someone who likes to work on contemporary history, public health, is that I think academics and non-academics need to differentiate between policy documents, i.e. rhetoric, and actual work unfolding of policy. There are big differences. We need to examine the complex basis of acceptance and also compliance. Sometimes it's compliance. Indirect pressure is being put on people to accept certain health regimes. I think it is important, and I learned this from my research, my oral interview work in the field, that we have to avoid the science stroke rationality and religion stroke irrationality dichotomy, the binary. Things are often more complex, somewhere in the middle. People could often believe in several remedies, often taken and practiced simultaneously. The WHO worker could check for disease, immunize, isolate, but then go away, after which the patient could choose to do other things. So this is where I've highlighted the fact that I've found large number of cases of vaccinators got their vaccination kits blessed in the local temples, which I find fascinating. And therefore, I think it's important to consider widening our understanding of the process of prevention, rather than depending on a narrow medicalized notion of the word prevention. That there is a medical aspect to it, but there also has to be a deeply social aspect to it, where you negotiate in different ways with different stakeholders in different localities. Time consuming, expensive, but at least you ensure that the next team of vaccination team, vaccinators that go in are not chased out of the village. So long-term gains. Here I'm speaking to the experts, so feel free to, you know, throw the big bats, but this is something I'm sort of thinking aloud, lessons for the future. I think community involvement important for all health programs. Make individuals feel that ideas are being exchanged, that they're not being dictated by outsiders. Recently, with a team that is primarily based in Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi, we started looking at aspects of the polio eradication program. And there was a strong feeling amongst local primary public health workers that their views were not being taken aboard, that, you know, the ideas were top down. Some of them actually said, but it wasn't like this when I was a young public health worker in the smallpox eradication program. There seemed to be more exchange of ideas. It may be a broader view in the field. I think internationalism was important because internationalism, I argue, was a gateway to open-mindedness. When you have an international team with people from different countries, from different institutional backgrounds, the fact that you have to talk to each other, listen to each other, and design policies based on a series of individual experiences about how to run public health, because you're open-minded amongst yourselves, you become open-minded about taking on new ideas from the field as well. In relation to polio eradication, from the research I've done, there seem to be doubts about the true epidemiological position in relation to polio. How is the disease being perceived by those targeted? What is actually being resisted? And this is where I think that DVD story I told you is important. Until I think those answers, those questions are answered, it might be very difficult to deal with the outbreaks in Uttar Pradesh. And what are the possible lessons for the planned strengthening of primary healthcare? I think, first of all, we have to find out what is the true primary healthcare coverage in India. One of the things that comes up very strongly by studying history of smallpox eradication in India, is that you had a description of primary healthcare structures on paper, which did not necessarily coincide with actually primary healthcare structures in the field. So you would often have smallpox teams going village to village, subdivision to subdivision, district to district, trying to find out were there cases. And they had been empowered to ask local primary healthcare workers for help when required. They often found empty shells, buildings where the primary healthcare workers were absconding, sometimes for private practice, sometimes for other reasons. So what you then had is this being reported back to state government and federal government, and the primary healthcare the framework actually being strengthened in response to this intelligence. So if we move away from theoretical sort of models about how vertical programs always weaken horizontal programs and look at field practice, actuality, in relation to the complexities of India, we notice that at least in the smallpox eradication story in eastern India, very important part of the eradication program, an adaptive vertical program, a program that was constantly adapting to local complexities, actually strengthened the primary healthcare coverage. So maybe that lesson gives us some sort of hope for the future about how vertical and horizontal can be interconnected in productive ways. So I'll end there so that I can answer any questions that people might have. And I really look forward to learning, being corrected, and learning from you as well. So thank you.
How do you want questions? You want to take a few at one? One at a time.
Whatever you think this chair is.
Thanks very much, Sanjoy. That's one of the most provocative presentations I think we've had, so there must be a few people just very keen to come back into that. So I'd like to open this up for your questions and comments and discussion, and I would be very grateful if you'd identify yourselves individually when you pose that, so that Sanjoy has an idea of who you are if he doesn't already know you. And this will all end up on our Global Health Histories website, and the PowerPoint presentation will be there, and it's also being recorded on sound, so that eventually we'll have it on CD if somebody wants to hear the whole thing again. Anyway, thank you very much, Sanjoy, and the floor's open. Who would like to be first? This lady here.
See your third point there is talking about open-mindedness, and you're also talking about taking on board communities' views and looking at it from a community perspective. And I noticed that two of the most successful interventions that you mentioned were kind of looking at, kind of negotiating on the terms of the vaccinators, in terms of giving a vaccination to each of the workers, or offering some repayment for people who identified cases. So just wondered if you could talk a little bit about the balance between kind of negotiating from the vaccinator's perspective and the local community's perspective, and kind of the sustainability of that, and how much it's happening on each person's terms, how it can be integrated into the community perspective.
Very good question, thank you. At one level, I think Peter and Adeline can throw more light on this. Vaccinators had to vaccinate themselves, I don't know how many times, to convince the people who were about to be vaccinated that it was safe. That was, I think, the most important part, perhaps, of negotiations with target communities, perhaps more so than rewards for information about smallpox cases. But I think the active efforts in the 1970s on part of some managers to empower local health officials, get their voices heard, and what I mean by local health officials is people actually from those subdivisions or those districts who would be part of teams, to get their voices across, their views across about complexities, which then would be studied in detail, was an important part of community negotiations. If if information came in about a series of expected problems from such workers, efforts were made to find out if A, others believed that, you know, those problems might arise more widely, and if yes, what were the best ways to negotiate with village headmen or the elders in a village, depending on the social composition of villages and the way individual villages and administrations were run. So I think that this open-mindedness refers to that willingness to listen to information that I would say in the 1960s was just not part of working policy, was a very important part of community negotiation. I've also heard from several people who've been interviewed that local communal representatives would ask for other things that were missing, other medicines for the children or other health facilities before supporting smallpox eradication. And I know that officially WHO workers were not allowed to dabble in local politics or be engaged in promising other facilities. But there are cases where people would stop when they were medically trained and provide the sort of help that was being requested just so that it was easier for them then to negotiate vaccination afterwards. So I think that is another important form of community negotiation. Does that answer your question, or sort of partially?
I was kind of wondering, I don't want to carry on answering the question, but I was wondering about the kind of the frame that the local people would put that vaccination into.
There are a variety of frames, and that's what I'm trying, what I'd really like academics and non-academics to study. There were various explanations about why the disease was occurring, you know, who was to fault. Often outsiders and villagers would be blamed. Sometimes when you study the situation closely, the outsider was usually the most economically depressed person who would be the, you know, would be blamed for bringing in the disease. And there were a variety of ways in which the disease was understood. Some understood it in terms of within a biomedical category that we tend to also sort of read about in Government of India publications or WHO publications. So for others, you know, it was an infection, but also Devi Ka Den, so, you know, a gift from the goddess. So should we be treating it, or should we suffer for a while and then treat it? You know, all sorts of views. So I think what you're getting at is very important, that the WHO's way of framing, or the WHO workers' way of framing the disease, was not necessarily always the community's way of framing the basis of the disease.
Thanks. I'm not sure whether Dev or Soko was first, but Soko.
One bit of history.
Socrates Litsios, for those who don't know you.
I joined WHO in 67, and it was a research division of epidemiology. And one of the events that I remember very clearly is Eli Henderson giving a talk on the eradication of smallpox, his vision of how smallpox would be eradicated. And the thing that most impressed me at the time were all my epidemiological colleagues saying, impossible. Impossible. Simply impossible. The disease would change its nature, and it just couldn't happen. On the open-mindedness, that's a very tricky question, because it applies to all levels, presumably.
Yes.
I mean, malaria history shows very clearly that the eradicationists of the 50s and 60s did not want to hear the voices of those who did not believe in the possibility of malaria eradication. So expert committees simply were not allowed to have members that didn't believe. And if you look at the whole history of the selective primary health care.
Yeah.
There you have the Director General of WHO and the Executive Director of UNICEF. An open-minded situation would have had an open debate.
Yes.
On selective versus, and yet they could not talk to each other.
Yes.
I mean, it's a very, very deep issue. I believe in it totally, but the organization, any organization that can live that kind would have to be very strong, and the individuals working in it would have to be very secure.
Yes.
And people's jobs in these kinds of organizations are not very secure.
Should we let Dev speak, or do you want to answer that?
Please.
Dev? Dev Ray?
My name is Dev Ray. I used to also work here. I think, Sanjay, it was a very great presentation, chopping out in such a brief period all the part of the history of smallpox eradication. I don't know much about it, but two observations come into my mind. One is, you had some throwaway lines regarding, of course, the opposition of the Indian government, one understands, but also the role of the regional office. I'd like you to expand on it.
Why?
Because it's of interest. The second point is this whole question of vertical and horizontal, and which also touches on the question asked. Now, community involvement is the basis of primary healthcare. But in reality, when the primary healthcare people that I have met, they're all a little bit top down, except for those who have proved it by working there.
Yeah.
So WHO people, with all the apologies to the current staff, who were involved in primary healthcare, they knew the answers and were telling others. Mm. Although they are preaching community involvement, they didn't do it. Why? In things like polio or, let's say, smallpox eradication, you had to do that in order to show results. So that's a major difference. Would you have some comments on it? So one is the question
very
of the
naughty.
Office, the other one is where do we go from here? It's taking away a bit from Sokol's line of thought, but I think.
No, I mean, firstly, I mean, I agree with you, Sokol, but the point remains is that if you can create, as an international worker, a situation where local voices are being heard, and what I mean by local is truly local, not national. I'm not talking about officials. I'm not talking about officials sitting in air-conditioned offices in the health ministry who go in air-conditioned jeeps, step out for 5 minutes, get back into the jeep and say, we've towed the area. But actually talking to health workers who are there, who live there, then I think getting those voices heard, even if they are not what you want to hear, can be a very important source of intelligence, health intelligence. So that's my response. And I know we agree because we've had lots of discussions about this, but it's a thorny issue, but we need to deal with it. Regional office politics in the Sierra region is could make a wonderful Bollywood movie or several Bollywood movies, but all I should really say is that the regional director opposed smallpox eradication, and there was a major problem. He would not release his funds. He didn't believe it could happen. He gave his own explanations, which made perfect sense to him. Didn't necessarily make sense to DA and his supporters. But after the 1968 reorganization, you had the creation of a unit within CRO in Delhi with the wonderful Nicole Grasset running it, who was a direct line of communications between DA and New Delhi. And that annoyed the regional director, but there was very little he at that point could do apart from the reason. If you look at Government of India papers, because it's difficult to find in WHO papers for understandable reasons, but if you look at Government of India papers, those opposing smallpox eradication from within Government of India were in constant touch with the regional director. So I think that says quite
that's
a lot.
Some more?
No, second question.
Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon. Okay, better hand, we'll get there.
Vertical versus a horizontal. When I was interviewing a junior paramedical officer in Madhya Pradesh as part of my India book, you know, he asked me to describe to him what vertical and horizontal meant. He claimed he didn't understand. So when I laid out the theoretical models as described by Debabrata Banerjee, he scratched his head and he said, so after smallpox, primary healthcare was the next vertical program, was it? So yes, I agree with you that it was initially very top-down, and that is where I think the challenges now lie. In its new avatar, is it going to be like that? Or is it going to be community, truly sort of involving communities. And what I mean by truly involving communities is, again, empowering the largest number of voices in a locality to be heard. And international workers can make that happen through tact and diplomacy. But they are the neutral observers. They can record views. They can take back views to the regional office. They can bring views to Geneva. Those views can be raised in important meetings. So the international workers of all nationalities, whether they're Indian or non-Indian, have an incredibly important role to play. But Sokka pointed out, jobs are not always secure, and there is, even in universities, there is politics. But we have a social responsibility, no? If we want to make it succeed this time around. It didn't succeed last time. In India.
How do you measure success?
Well, you have to set out indicators. Who are you targeting? At least that's what local people I've spoken to seem to think. You know, who is it that primary healthcare structures are targeting? Is it maternal and childcare, or is it something broader than that? If something is broader than that, are we talking about a geographical region that is going to be serviced? How is that geographical region to be divided? Who is going to be targeted? What is the general profile of some of the schemes? You know, do we tackle women and children first and then males later? And then once that has been set out, I think it is relatively easier to get success. I mean, have those, you know, has the ambition of providing broad-based care as defined at the outset been met? What you had in, what we see from the history of primary health care and selective primary health care is that the goals are become far less ambitious in a very small sort of period of time. And there is no clear indicator of what the new targets are going to be and how success is going to be measured. So if success, we define, if you and I standing here agree that success means meeting the basic targets. And there might be many definitions of success from the other side as well, which we have to study, which I haven't studied, so I can't talk about right now. Then you know, who watches over us while we try to provide this broad-based care? Or is it, again, what history of primary health care tells us, that it was just, sometimes in the Indian case at least, just shifting officials between different departments and creating new titles, and they said, oh, we have a primary health care structure. But surely primary health care structures have to be something deeper, something, some, a new cadre of officials to make sure the primary healthcare centers are actually manned, that there are personnel running these places in rural India. There's no mechanism last time for that. Just having that would be one success, I think.
Can I take, thank you very much, Bedirhan?
Thank you, it was a very enlightening presentation for me. I joined WHO poster education.
Do you know each other?
No.
I'm Peter Henderson, coordinator for classification, terminology, and standards. And for many people at the 60th anniversary of WHO, smallpox eradication is one of the very first success stories that WHO has achieved in the first 60 years. And it's almost become a myth. I mean, you have some sort of demystified that myth and provide us some sort of an emic story about how it took place. There were very much debating that. My question really refers to how can we make generalizations from this emic story to other levels? You alluded to teleological history, to epistemology, to the DVD that carries the smallpox experience to polio and so forth. I had heard once, health economists are against eradication of disease because it costs much, but once it's eradicated, they are very happy because
saves much.
You know, they have the huge savings and so forth. So from this case study, what can we generalize for WHO for lessons learned for polio, for malaria, for HIV in the future? Because there are 12,000 other diseases that we need to be eradicating if we adopt this line.
And Ritu wants one next. Do you want to take it?
So I'll take this one because it's a
Ritu
big question.
Next, okay? Thanks, go ahead.
It depends how you present the case study of smallpox eradication. I mean, there are some histories that you can point to which are unilinear and it seems universal, and therefore you can, it seems, transfer lessons from one case study to another relatively easily. I actually think smallpox eradication was incredible because so many people expected it to fail. It succeeded against all odds. And someone, I'm Indian, but from Delhi, but when I did my research and had to go from district to district and spend a lot of time in rural India, I started appreciating what some of the smallpox warriors would have encountered in the field, and I was full of admiration because it wasn't easy. I mean, I lost count of the number of times I had food poisoning or diarrhea or once jaundice. So there are challenges. But I think if you take this way of presenting the case study, what this tells you, I hope, is that there were many ideas about how to eradicate the disease based on many ideas about how to deal with challenges coming up from specific localities. And I think studying the area where programs are going to be targeted at in great detail is important, and that is something that smallpox eradication teaches us. Now, I think there were divisions in the program, I'm not highlighting that. There were those who believed that mass immunization was the way forward and continued doing mass immunization. So now I'm going to be even more provocative. So how was smallpox eradicated? Was it only containment surveillance? My argument is no. Because there were those who did containment surveillance and they did it very well. They had their 5 or 6 definitions, but they did it very well. But there were large numbers of Indian health officials who believed that mass immunization was the only way forward and continued immunizing, and sometimes only with Indian vaccine. So if you look at a mosaic, and I think D.A. Henderson hints at this in his big red book, that a variety of practices helped eradicate smallpox. Containment and surveillance was a very, very important part of it, but not the only part. And I think that open-mindedness, that the realization that you might have to deploy multiple strategies, that there is no one-size-fits-all policy, I think would be a very important step towards eradicating other diseases. I don't know if your question is important and a very big one, but...
Okay, can I just say I have Ritu, and then I have Joan, and then I have this gentleman.
I'm Ritu, yes. Coordinating a group on equity analysis and research. You mentioned a lot about the issues of what is contested and the issues of potential control, top-down or even laterally, and yet the benefits of what actually, the outcome of it was actually a success. And how has that experience, because it was somewhat contemporary, was it useful or not at all useful in another very big program in India, somewhat at the same time and even afterwards, in terms of family planning?
Hmm.
A very different type of issue, but were there lessons or benefits, or was there nothing that was gained, given that the family planning program, the way it was run and what was contested, was quite, I think, perhaps more extreme.
Well, I think one of the most shameful episodes of Indian history is part of the family planning program, which involves the forcible sterilization of young Muslim men in camps during the period of emergency announced by Indira Gandhi. And at least during the campaign, whenever people like Nicole Brasse or Larry Brilliant or, tried to convince federal officials, including the Prime Minister, that they needed to have the largest possible support from government officials, I think an effort was made to keep an eye out for some of the controversial policies and then not use officials associated to those controversial policies in the localities. And there was good reason for that, because at least in Bihar, when those associated with family planning, who were in the 1970s during the emergency, associated with forcible sterilization, were seen to be supporting smallpox eradication search missions or containment missions, there was a lot of nervousness. And new sorts of opposition arose because there was a fear that perhaps this was not about smallpox, perhaps this was another driver, indirect way to collect information about family sizes, about sterilization. So I think I need to study what happened after Indira Gandhi's government fell and the new Janata coalition came into being. I would suspect there was an attempt to completely distance government from forcible sterilization and develop a more community informed strategy of family health, but I don't know. I haven't studied it in detail, and I'm grateful for the question because I need to study this in greater detail. But those involved in smallpox eradication, the teams, I think just as in WHO structures, were disbanded, I think, far too quickly. And there's a political explanation for that as well, or a series of political explanations. But people who didn't expect this to succeed, and then they found it succeed, it had been certified a success. In fact, a lot of the senior managers in India said that either they were unhappy in their jobs afterwards or looked to move abroad for research positions because they were given such a hard time once they returned to their old jobs. In such a situation, I think, again, there would have been a partial acceptance of some of what was learned. Because if the people who were involved in making eradication people were isolated, I wonder how much their ideas would have filtered through to other programs. But in India, certainly, I feel that the teams are disbanded without any thought of the fact that they might have actually helped in other programs. I mean, there was guinea worm eradication that MID Sharma launched, and that was classed a success in India as well. But MID Sharma, from what I hear, was a different, you know, he had access to the politicians, he was very confident, he has broad-based political connections. But I don't know why the local teams were disbanded so quickly and not involved in new programs. In Bangladesh, I'm told many of the smallpox workers, local workers, became an important part of the primary healthcare structures. And that was, they knew from the very beginning that being part of smallpox was training for another mission, primary healthcare. And that is where, as someone who comes from India, it's very, very, very important not to assume that you study the Indian case study and you have the whole South Asia story. You don't. There are specificities.
Thank you. Joan, and then over here.
I'm Joan Zanowagis. I work in e-health. And I really resonated to the concept of what I call medical chauvinism or medical imperialism. And I think that resonates throughout the disease programs and in certain ways, and I've seen it in my own research, but in fact I work in e-health right now, and I'm seeing it in e-health, because you ask the question, what is actually being resisted? And we have our own resistance, and that is when you look at Web 2.0 and user-generated content and Wikipedia and so on, and the whole move to people's voices being more important in their own care in terms of chronic care management and so on, using these new technologies, you see it there too. And I wonder if you would speak to sort of that evolution through the period. How it sort of started there and how you see it going.
I think it's always been there. I mean, I think Soko will correct me, but I mean, that was one of the, when you read discussions here, what the archives tell us about what is being said here post abandonment of malaria eradication and what's being said in a country like India, there is reference to chauvinism, close-mindedness, and the fact that, you know, unwillingness to engage with other viewpoints, to health intelligence coming from sources that are not trusted, and usually sources of information that involved the target population was not trusted because, you know, is that what you're talking about?
Well, kind of, but even looking at our own TRIP reports from the 1960s, yeah, in a few ways, we see an anger and frustration when women would wash DDT off the walls of their huts because they stained the walls. And you see those kinds of things coming through in WHO's staff on attitudes. And so, but I think what we have to be careful about internally is not to carry that attitude even into this age where in the advent of all these new technologies, we're saying, well, you know, you can't trust that information on the internet, you can't trust this. Well, it's not medically correct, yet it's the way people think about and engage with their own health. Mm. And so it's sort of drawing a parallel between what we've done and how we're still playing that chauvinism out.
Well, what I would again highlight is the fact that I think if you look at all the public health programs, malaria, smallpox, I suppose, polio, there are variation of attitudes. Some people are more open to that information than others. So the question is, what can the ones who are willing to listen to such information able to do with it, or were able to do with it? In the smallpox case, my sense is that there were those who would ignore this information coming through, but there were a very large number who would listen to this, try to follow up this information, and then apply it in policy, which I think is one of the bases for the acceptance of the program in localities. But there was always a significant element that would not engage with those views or take those views, that information seriously. And that was a major problem. There's always been a technological fix. No, I mean, with malaria, it was DDT. Smallpox, it was initially freeze-dried vaccine, then bifurcated needle. Those are all very important. But one of the many important things that made smallpox eradication possible, not the only thing, and access to information, listening to information, I think was a very important part of that program. So I agree with you, because you know, the polio vaccine technology might be improved, and I hope it is. It becomes more heat stable and more reliable. But is that the only basis for eradication, or are there other ways in which more broad-based communal support can be mobilized? Maybe by thinking about information coming in, you can get more socialized ideas about disease eradication in the future. So I agree with you.
Maybe we should have a seminar on the history of health on the internet. Would you do that for us, John? Please.
Peter.
Peter Carrasco, Department of Vaccine, Immunization, Vaccine, Biolabs. Alan, too, here, and I, we serve in very smallpox campaigns in 3 or 4 countries. To answer some of the questions and help Sandor here explain something, the first thing about medical chauvinism, we didn't have to face that much, because when you went into the field and you saw, and the community was there, they saw their own people die of a very horrible disease, they were willing to take vaccination. When there was no disease, and in far remote parts of Ethiopia, where Alan and I were serving, where the disease would come or would go, there was a little more of a problem of getting people to accept vaccination. But the way to do that, as Sandra has pointed out, you have to have this open mind, and each of us who worked with in the different campaigns at the local level had to sit down. We had to sit down maybe half a day, a whole day, drink 10 cups of coffee with a bottle of butter in Ethiopia to get him to order his people to get vaccinated. But we had to go through that process. And each WHO and even the local Ethiopian or in Bangladesh, the district officer would accompany us, and they would do the talking, and we would just sit by and just wait to see things happen. So it's very different from the malaria program. You threw DDT, whatever, on, but mosquitoes were there 2 weeks later. Now, with smallpox, they saw death, and they saw it stop, and they saw the transmissions ceased in a wide area. So that success, and seeing that success, which you could see within a short time, made the people more accessible, made them more friendly, and wanted to be protected against disease. Now, the last thing I want to make is on primary health care, and is that smallpox, as you know, Sanjoy, we were bad at being vertical. But remember, it was a health system's first expression to get out there again after the malaria fiasco and get to people and protect them with an intervention. Okay? And malaria, the malaria fiasco kind of froze a curative structure in place. And it took a very conservative approach. And then primary health care was developed, and it sounded great on paper, but they had no operational capacity. Mm. Coupled with that, which is has not been exposed here in this lecture, is that access to the structure, whether it was India or Bangladesh, was very limited. In Ethiopia, it was very limited. The one health post they had, and they had very good health auxiliaries or nurses manning the Ethiopian health post. But very few people would take their time, or could take their time, to walk 2 days or 3 days to this health post. But it was only smallpox that then made that first vertical outreach to say, here, we can deliver something for you. And it started building up some capacity of the health system to see that you could do something in the future. And that gave way to what we now call expanded program and immunization, as the people came together and said, how do we keep this alive? And what Sanjoy said was correct. A lot of the structure that was created just shriveled up, and we lost a big opportunity at the end of 72 in some countries, 75 in some countries, to take that structure forward. And it took quite a bit of time, and I think that is why today, when you look at the EPI program, it took 20 years to go from 17% coverage back up to 80.
It's wonderful to have this personal experience, this eyewitness. Thanks very much, Peter. Do you want to answer that one, or do you want to take another?
No, I agree. Huh? I agree. No, I agree with him. So, I mean,
Sorry, I know that this gentleman wanted to, but I think this may be a little connected, and then we'll come. Is that okay with you?
Yeah.
Right, thanks. Alan.
Just to add to what Peter said, he mentioned a few things I wanted to. In terms of medical chauvinism, one case in India, one district, we went into a village where there was cases reported, the immunization work had started about 3 days before I got there. And we arrived and saw that they had immunized less people than expected. So the first thing we did was meet with the village Pradhan and said, what's up, what's going on here? And he was very upset with the local vaccinator, which was coming from the primary health center in that PHC area, a block. And he said the person was being rude, he was forcing people to get vaccination, he was touching the women. He was very upset with that vaccinator. We sat down and said, okay, the vaccinator's leaving. We sent him back to the PHC. We continued to work with other teams and took that down out with us the next day to do the immunization, to see what we were doing. So that's an example maybe of approaching, okay, why is the work not going well? And that we were very much receptive. What do you want to do? What do you think we should do? That village worked well. We could control that outbreak. The issue of vertical programs, the gentleman has left, I think, for eradication programs. There are only a few diseases which have the qualities to be eradicated, be able to get rid of the pathogen. Malaria, not the candidate for eradication. We can't get rid of the cause of the disease. But I know for economics that when you have no more disease, you can stop all intervention, so they estimate you save about $1 billion a year from smallpox eradication. So it's a special case, smallpox eradication. But I think in addition to the economic benefit is that, say we hadn't eradicated smallpox, say we failed, that it came back again. I think there'd still be no more cases in Switzerland or in Sweden, but you'd have routine outbreaks in these most poorest, backwards areas, because they're the people who wouldn't get vaccinated. So I think we need to keep in mind that the eradication program protects the poorest and the weakest in the society. We shouldn't lose sight of that. I agree with Peter that EPI did take up where smallpox left off. The ADG in India, the government, the central government, the leader of the immunization program is Dr. Arun Basu, who had been the leader of smallpox eradication as well. And EPI worked very well in India, with a few states, with the exception Bihar and UP. But in most parts of the country, EPI worked well. The coverage went from 10% with probably vaccine that wasn't potent up to 70-80% with very good vaccine. So So there were some benefits at that.
And if I could just add here that, you know, sometimes I go to meetings, I hear people talk, and sometimes when I'm interviewing people, I come across the view that smallpox eradication was easy. It wasn't easy. And that's where I think historians need to come in and remind the people that it wasn't easy. It was made possible because of a variety of factors, including a willingness of workers, both Indian and international, to spend huge amounts of time in the field. Huge, huge amounts of time in the field. So I think one of the myths that we need to get rid of before any lessons can be transferred was that the job was easy and other diseases are more difficult to eradicate. So there are systemic problems that had to be overcome, and they did it in that time and that place. Question is, can we do it? We have to ask ourselves for other diseases in other locations.
We're almost out of time. If that gentleman would like a quick question, we've got about a minute.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Anand Balachandran from the Polio Eradication Initiative. And I have two quick comments. I've just come back from Western UP just this past Sunday, monitoring campaigns for more than 10 days. And I would be very careful about generalizing smallpox eradication and the interaction with community and trying to get some broad lessons from that example and trying to use that in other areas, primarily because of the duration of interaction with the recipients. For polio in places like Western UP, you're talking about 9 to 12 interactions with these mothers and fathers and communities every year in these highly endemic areas. And the question of what are they resisting is not a static event. It keeps changing. A couple of years ago, it was Islamic communities, lots of rumors, urine, e-health. The internet is playing a really horrible role in that context of spreading these rumors and media picking up on it. A few years ago, it was Islamic communities resisting. Now, the resistance I saw just a week ago is government failure. Public health services, other than polio, nothing else is coming to their village. They don't have water, electricity, roads, absolutely nothing. So communities are using this one critical intervention that has sort of global visibility, and the government is putting $300 million into this program this year. And they are using it very differently in terms of resisting a government program in order to receive other benefits that they have not received. So it's highly, highly complex, like what you're saying. But I would take a few things from the smallpox eradication initiative, but I think the political economy of India has changed considerably from the 70s. And we also need to take that into consideration. Maybe 50 years from now, somebody will be doing it. Presentation on polio, and it'll be even more complex than smallpox eradication.
Thank you very much.
Can I respond?
Yes, of course.
I'm just a bit surprised that you found out about this in the last 10 days, because there have been articles published about community negotiation for other facilities. Maybe they're published in Indian journals that are not widely read here, but
this
information has been out
for
a while.
This is my direct experience just a few days ago.
No, and I'm very grateful. I'm very, very grateful for that. But it's not just Islamic communities. I mean, the other thing that struck us is there's not been detailed investigation of the northeastern wing of India, where Christian clerics are saying the same things in churches. So just because outbreaks haven't been reported from the northeast yet, it's not... So it's not just Islam, it's certain Muslim or Christian leaders using religion for political purposes. And so we need to engage with that, try and understand that better, and then deal with the problem. And that is what struck us, that especially in Mizoram and Meghalaya, you have Christian clerics actively in the Sunday services advocating resistance to polio immunization. Rumors, very, very problematic category. I mean, we all know that there was one batch of polio vaccine that made some children very ill in Assam. That was exaggerated beyond recognition and created nervousness amongst parents. But we, I think, have to understand that nervousness and engage with it. It's not just rumors. Some of the rumors are problematic because there is a feeling, at least in the local press, we've spoken to editors of Urdu newspapers.
Lots.
Yes? That the true epidemiological position isn't coming out. That they are under pressure not to report the true epidemiological position. Now, one of the things that a historian has studied in smallpox eradication is that D.A. Henderson and his team said, however bad the news is, put it out. Because if we don't put it out and people find out, we have no credibility. I don't see that resonance in polio from the studies we've done. And I'm perfectly willing to accept that the people you studied and the people we've studied perhaps are different. But again, I'm going to come back and I'm going to bang on about this. Variations in attitudes. So the people we studied are thinking differently. People you are studying are thinking differently. Lesson of history is we need to study both, engage with both, and adapt policy to both. That's all I'm saying. I don't think we have to wait 50 years. I think we'll be writing the history of this one sooner than that.
I hope so. It's been a fantastic discussion. Thank you very much for coming. Thanks, Sanjoy.